Hero Collector welcomes you to an all-new episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel. This is Jeremy Bement, your host, welcoming you to another episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel. In this episode, we are going to take a very detailed look at the Harlan Ellison City on the Edge of Forever original teleplay. This book was put out originally by IDW Publishing, and we are going to take a look at this wonderful story. In this episode, we will start out by taking a look at the latest Star Trek comic news. I want to get you all up to speed as to what is going on in the way of Star Trek comics. And then we will do a review of the City on the Edge of Forever miniseries. We'll take a look at it, and I'll tell you what my thoughts on it. And then after that, we'll have an interview, a chat with the artist of this miniseries, artist J.K. Woodward. He is one of the well-known Star Trek comic artist over the past decade or longer, and it was great to sit down and chat with him and take a look at this great story. I hope this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel finds you well. I hope you are hunkered down, maintaining your social distancing, and I hope all is well in your area of the world. And now with this out of the way, let's get into this wonderful episode. This is the third episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, and I've been doing a very deep dive into Star Trek collector editions and graphic novels, and thank goodness for Hero Collector, because when I decided to come up with this podcast, I thought, what would be the easiest way for me to get a bunch of these stories and review them and talk to the writers and the artists about them? And Hero Collector is the best way to do it if you are just starting out collecting Star Trek comics, because they have an awful lot of graphic novels available. All their graphic novels are nice hardcover editions, reprinting great stories from the whole history of Star Trek. From the story that we're covering today, Harlan Ellison's The City on the Edge of Forever, which came out from IDW just not too long ago. But they go all the way back to reprinting the Gold Key issues. In fact, if you take a look in this book, The City on the Edge of Forever, they reprint a Star Trek or Star Trek number 2 from Gold Key, which has its own special charm, even though they really didn't know the cast of Star Trek all that well. So if you are interested in pursuing reading some Star Trek stories that maybe you don't have in your collection, maybe you've collected Star Trek comics off and on over the years, but you would like to do what I'm doing and going through and reading all the Star Trek comics you can possibly get your hands on, go to HeroCollector.com, and you can take a look and see the click on the tab for Star Trek graphic novels and get signed up for their subscription service, where they send out collected editions to you every so often. They look really nice when you get them on your bookshelf, because all the spines go together to make pictures of all the ships that we all know and love from all the different lines of Star Trek. And not only that, but they have other stuff available. You can collect Star Trek ships. They have models of Star Trek ships. They have Batman Through the Decades figures. They got WWE figures. Just tons and tons of stuff at Hero Collector. So make sure you go and check them out. Thank them for sponsoring Star Trek Panel to Panel. Go to HeroCollector.com and get signed up for the Star Trek graphic novels. You're not going to regret it.
Incoming transmission.
In the latest Star Trek comic news on this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, I go to a place called thetrekcollective.com to check for my latest Star Trek comic news, that and the IDW website. And there's an excellent article that came out on Tuesday, April 7th, entitled Star Trek Comics Update, Delayed Releases, Con, Gary 7, Another Year 5 Covers, and More, that I'm going to borrow from them and share with you. It's an excellent article. I will post a link to it on my Facebook page, and make sure you check it out. Basically, it says, lots of Star Trek comics updates today, but maybe the last big update for in a little while, as the comics industry goes into hibernation over the COVID-19 crisis period. Continue below to check out a bunch of new covers, artwork, and other updates. Basically, it says that a couple weeks ago, Diamond announced that they are going to suspend sending comics out to distributors or to comic shops for the foreseeable future, and IDW also announced that they would be reducing planned publications initially through July. basically it says, according to this article, delayed will be year 5 from issue 11 onwards. That issue was originally due to be out in February. The con-focused original series Mirror Universe one-shot that was supposed to come out in March has been delayed. The new DS9 series, Too Long a Sacrifice, which was due to start in April, has been delayed. And the reissue of the graphic novel Debt of Honor from Chris Claremont and Adam Hughes. Before everything ground to a halt, StarTrek.com did put up a preview for the imminent release of Year 5, issue number 11. But that issue didn't quite make it out into the real world as yet. But so basically, you can understand the whole comic industry is ground to a halt, except for DC Comics, which is going to start sending out comics through a couple new distributors. So it's the comics industry has been shaken to its core in that a major comic retailer or publisher is going to be using a distributor or distributors other than Diamond Comics for the first time in 20 years, which is, that's big news. But doesn't really involve Star Trek, so we'll just kind of skip over that for now. But like I said, this article from the TrekCollective.com, if you check this article out, there's lots of preview art. They did an excellent job of presenting some covers and stuff that various different artists have put out there saying, here's upcoming artwork from upcoming Star Trek comics that have been delayed. Make sure you check this article out. And there will be Star Trek comics coming out at some point from IDW. We just have to wait and see when everything gets back up and running again. And that is the latest Star Trek comic news.
Accessing library computer data.
In this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, like we've been saying from the beginning, we are taking a look at Harlan Ellison's The City on the Edge of Forever, the original teleplay. I personally have the Hero Collector edition of this, and let me read you what it says on the back of the book. Stardate unknown. Dr. McCoy, after accidentally injecting himself with an overdose of a hallucinogenic medicine, travels through a portal to the past, causing the whole future to change. Kirk and Spock must follow him to New York City during the Great Depression in order to find him and repair the timeline before it is irreparably damaged. The stunning graphic novel adaptation of the penultimate episode of Star Trek's first season is based on Harlan Ellison's original award-winning teleplay and features Ellison's own introduction. That description there basically tells you the plot synopsis of the story that we all know and love from classic Star Trek, The City on the Edge of Forever. However, what this book is, this is the original Harlan Ellison teleplay adapted by writers Scott and David Tipton and artwork by wonderful artist J.K. Woodward. This book has an introduction by Harlan Ellison, and what the blurb on the back of the volume doesn't tell you is that there's a slight change to this in this teleplay, which you'll find out when you read it. Originally, Harlan Ellison's story had a crew member taking a jewel that was a drug, a hallucinogenic drug, which causes him to go through the portal, and Kirk and Spock go after him to try to get him back. Not only that, there's some space pirates involved. But this story, back then, it was too controversial to have somebody taking hallucinogenic drugs, which caused the whole story to come about, so that's why they changed it to Dr. McCoy. That's the main difference that you'll notice when you read this story. It's interesting to see how much of the story has changed, but at the same time, it kind of remains the same in that when you read this adaptation of the original screenplay or teleplay, you'll definitely see stuff that you'll go, oh, I remember that from the episode, or oh, I remember this from the episode. It's interesting to see how the whole premise, the whole cause of them going back in time and how they go about going through going back in time is different, but you can still see how what ended up on the screen matches up fairly close beat for beat with what is in this book. The adaptation from Scott and David Tipton, I think, is perfectly fine. I think they did a good job of taking the teleplay and turning it into a comic a comic script and breaking it down page by page and panel by panel. Well, what really stands out here, what really shines, is J.K. Woodward's artwork. Like you'll hear in the interview from him here shortly, is that he's a huge Harlan Ellison fan from even back in the days when he was just getting into watching Star Trek. But you can tell that there's a lot of love for this episode that he puts into each and every page. You can just admire his artwork. If you like painted comic book artwork that looks photorealistic, you're in for a treat with this book. And there's not much more that needs to be said. J.K. Woodward stands head and shoulders above a lot of other comic artists out there, and you will definitely see that in this book. I don't really have too much else to say regarding this story other than it's a city on the edge of forever. It's a classic Star Trek tale, and having an adaptation that takes the original story that Harlan Ellison did so you can see how it would have looked on the TV screen is a great addition to your Star Trek comic collection, and one that I highly recommend. So make sure you go and seek this out. It's the adaptation of Harlan Ellison's The City on the Edge of Forever. Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, I have the pleasure of talking to the artist of Harlan Ellison's City on the Edge of Forever, J.K. Woodward. J.K., thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I chatted with you back quite some time ago from my Doctor Who podcast about the Star Trek Next Generation Doctor Who crossover that you did for IDW. How long have you been doing stuff for IDW?
I started around the same time that Chris Rael started there. I think the company started in 2000 or 2001.
Okay.
Chris came on in 2004, and one of the early things he did in his career there was hire me to do a book called CSI New York. So sent in some painted samples and told him I could do likenesses. So he immediately put me on that. So my first work was painting Gary Sinise. And then Peter David saw that at around the same time they were taking Fallen Angel, which had been canceled at DC, and bringing it over to IDW. And I got that gig, and we did that for about 3 years, and then I went to Star Trek. So I've been pretty much, with the exception of a few projects for Marvel and Image and Dark Horse, I think, I've been pretty much IDW guy this whole time.
Yeah, and I remember Fallen Angel from my days selling comic books and was wowed by your artwork back then. So I've been an admirer of yours for quite some time. And you've been a Star Trek fan forever and a day, haven't you? I was told by the Tipton brothers that you're one of the biggest experts that they know of.
Oh, well, that's very flattering coming from them, because they're they also have a kind of an encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek. Yeah, I mean, my earliest memories of Star Trek, I think, is watching it when I was like in syndication when I was 6 years old, the original series.
Sure.
And just loving it. And I remember when I was a senior in high school, or the summer before I was going to be senior in high school. I remember seeing the first commercial for Next Generation and just freaking out that there was a Klingon on the bridge and just, you know, holding my breath, waiting for that to happen. And, you know, of course, the movies, I think I was 9 or 10 years old when the motion picture came out, and it just was so visually stunning. It was my favorite show, but oh my God, they got the Star Wars effects budget. This is, so it's kind of, I always wanted Star Trek to have sort of the motion picture, you know, special effects treatment. And so I love that movie. And that just, kept me going my whole life. You know, I can go through the whole history of Star Trek, but whenever something new Star Trek comes out, I get excited. Let's just put it that way.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Now, for the story that I wanted to talk to you about today was The City on the Edge of Forever, that you did this wonderful collection or miniseries from IDW on that was reprinted by Hero Collector into this nice hardcover I have in front of me. How did you get involved in doing Harlan Ellison's version of it?
This decision, all of this had already been worked out when I got contacted about doing the job. So this is definitely a Chris Rael question, but he, I guess he had, I think he had contacted Harlan and just kind of worked it out and contacted the Tiptons to do, you know, to translate it into a comic script.
Uh-huh.
and decide how many issues and all that stuff. And then it came to me.
Okay.
How
excited were you to do this version of the Sea and the Age of Forever then? I guess I'll change my question a little bit.
Indescribably excited about doing it. I mentioned we talked a little bit. I've been a Star Trek fan since I was about 6 years old. I've been a Harlan Ellison fan since I was about seven and saw a movie at a drive-in. At that time, it was like about 2 years old, I think. So it was like the second feature at a drive-in. It was A Boy and His Dog, and I was just, who wrote this? I love it. I love the cynicism, because there's a kind of cynicism, but like a cynical humor to it that I hadn't seen before outside of Planet of the Apes, which really wasn't as humorous.
Yeah.
And I just became a fan and started looking for everything he could. I had no idea it wasn't appropriate for my age, but most of his work. But I quickly became a fan, and then that lasted my whole life. So, and then when I finally made the Star Trek connection to the name Harlan Ellison, that just blew my mind. And flash forward decades later, and I'm working with him. It just was an incredible, it's the most incredible moment. It's all been downhill from there, really.
Oh, really? Wow.
My whole life, yeah.
So going into this, basically what this is Harlan Ellison's original version of The Sea on the Edge of Forever. Going into this from an art standpoint, how did you decide to tackle this project? Did you want to kind of follow it along as using the original or the actual TV episode as a way to start off blocking out the story or figuring out the art for it? Or what thought process went through your mind on this one?
Well, artistically, I didn't want to hold anything back, because I remember a book in the 90s came out with the original script. So I'd read it before, and I knew there were space pirates in it. I knew there were these psychedelic jewels that made you high. Sound crystals or whatever they were called. I was familiar visually with what I had to do in this, and there was a lot to do. And it was all going to be fun, but I decided early on that except for a couple helicopter shots that I did in this, I was going to make this look like an episode. I wanted to see what it would look like if it was actually filmed. And so what I did is the scenes with, like, I used the same wardrobe for Kirk and Spock when they go back in time. The sets were a little different because I wanted it to kind of look a little more like New York and less like a Universal lot.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I tried to keep it grounded in what it would look like with that show budget, with the exception of a couple of panels where, like I said, I wanted to do like a Lord of the Rings helicopter shot of them walking across a planet, things like that. But for the most part, I tried to keep it grounded. Harlan always wanted to see this episode aired. So I wanted to give Harlan, I thought if I could give him that would be great.
Okay. You know? Yeah. From another question I have, from doing your art style, how do you go about getting reference material for what you're using to paint with?
Okay, you already know the answer to this, but because if you saw the book, I actually put some embarrassing photos of myself in there. I put on pajamas and play Star Trek in front of a camera, basically. I work out what the lighting would be in the scene. I have it all sketched out and blocked out, so we do like sketches first. But when it comes to reference material, I think I was wearing like Doc Martin boots and black pants and like a orange thermal shirt or something like that. But it looks Star Trek enough where you get the idea as a reference material. And I would pose out some of the shots and see what looked best, try different lighting, and then take what I want from that and use that as reference. And go from there. In the back of the book that you're talking about, you'll actually see the process. I go through the process step by step and show kind of photographs of it, which was the hardest thing to do because those are such embarrassing pictures of me.
how time consuming is it to get all those photo references put together?
Generally I do it like a few pages at a time. I'll probably spend a few hours just going through and acting out the panels, and I'll take a look at it. And then I'll probably usually do a reshoot if there's a couple I don't like or if I want to try a different angle. So generally less than a day. I tend to work 16 to 20 hour days while I'm working on a sequential project like this. Yeah, and that's 7 days a week until the project is done. So when I say half a day, probably 8 hours of working it all out, and then I'm ready to pencil. Depending on what other reference material I need, you know, like for instance, there was a scene on the 59th Street Bridge in Manhattan, connecting Manhattan to Queens. I was lucky because this was a bridge that was built at that time, and it happened to be a few blocks from where I was living at that time in New York. When I lived in New York. At this time, I had lived in Long Beach, but I used to live in that neighborhood. But I, you know, I wanted to get that right, so I have to research what it looked like back then and what the skyline looked like and things like that. So when something like that comes along, it takes a little longer, but generally, I don't know, about 8 hours every few pages. It's really not a big process.
Okay. For the backgrounds, what kind of references do you need to acquire or use for that? Is it difficult to do that, or is it easy?
It can be, but you know, we live in the age of Google searches, so finding images of you know, you pretty much type it in and it comes up. But you want to do a lot of cross-referencing with your research, because you might be getting a picture. It might be, for instance, you're making a mistake. You're basing your reference on an artist's interpretation of something that was going to happen in 1930 in Manhattan, but never did.
Okay.
You know, you want to make sure you got the right reference. So you have to do a little research to make sure. If you're going to do the research to make the, say, 1931 New York or 1929, I forget exactly what year, but if you're going to do the research to make it look that spot on, you don't want to screw that up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so I did exhausting research on that. I also little details, like I had to keep reminding myself this was during Prohibition and the Depression, but like Prohibition was still going on. This is where Prohibition and the Depression, it kind of intersected. So I wanted to put a bar in the background. And so I, you know, painted this bar, and I put a bunch of Easter eggs, Harlan Ellison Easter eggs. And I think I called it the TikTok bar based on the TikTok man or something like that. I don't remember all of them. They're all in the book, though.
Yep. You have a bunch of them listed in the back.
But after I drew the bar, I was like, oh, wait, Prohibition. So I put the amendment. I think it was it Amendment 19 was Prohibition, but anyways, whatever it was, I put the sign on the door and then put chains on the door, because that's what it looked like back then. But I that one almost went by me. So these are the things you have to think about, and sometimes if you got to think about things you didn't even know about. So what I did in that case was I had both Scott and David to talk to. And ask, I would run things by them too in pencil phase. And I would, of course, talk to Harlan to make sure I got the, you know, everything, if not accurate, at least accurate to what he was thinking, because this whole thing was all about what would it have looked like if he had full control.
Yeah. Speaking of Harlan, how closely did he follow along on this project, and how much did you get to ask him questions about whether it be the making of the original episode and what he was expecting the original episode to turn out to be, that he wanted to see in your artwork that he might not have gotten to see in the Classic Treks episode?
After meeting Harlan, I did the first couple of pages before meeting him. Okay. I got into page three, page two, was it two or three? It doesn't matter. But a page with a great sort of almost splash page of psychedelic imagery.
Page three.
And yeah, it was page three? Okay.
Yep.
So I got to that point when I met him, and Chris Ryle had told me I had to come down to Scott Tipton's store, which he had in North Hollywood at the time, where Harlan was doing a signing.
Okay.
And wanted me to meet him, and I was like, okay, well, I got to get this page done because this is the page I want him to see. After he'd seen my work, he was convinced before, because he's a friend with Peter David, so he'd seen my work on Fallen Angel. That's how he was kind of familiar with me. But when he wasn't sure about what I was going to do with his vision. So once he saw that, everything was great. We fast became friends, and I would actually talk to him almost daily while I was working on this, because I wanted to make sure we were on the same page, that we remained on the same page, because I did the first three pages without talking to him. And then after that, both Harlan would see it, both Scott would see it, Dave would see it, Chris would see it. this was not a close to the vest kind of thing. I was sharing it with everybody involved because we all wanted to make sure we got this just right.
Yeah.
But Harlan was definitely involved the whole time. In fact, there were a few I actually ended up putting him in the book at one point because I went over his house sometimes socially just to go out to dinner or something like that. And at one of these dinners, he was telling me the story about how he originally wrote the character of Trooper, who did not appear in the actual aired episode, for himself. He wanted to play that character in the worst way.
Okay.
So I drew him into the story. So we took a bunch of photos of himself, like reference photos, and I did kind of made him a little bit younger, but not too much because it was a war veteran. And we ended up putting him in the book, which was great because that was like a dream of his that he always wanted. And it's one of the things we could do for him.
Along those lines, if you look at the references that you have in the back or the kind of the director's notes, there was quite a few different people that you kind of snuck in here and there into your artwork.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it was at this point so long ago, I don't remember all of it, but it's all there in the back. We did a section of annotations that not only talks about the people I snuck in there, but also the Easter eggs. There's a lot of Harlan short stories in there. I think there is like a Tipton deli where I put the Tipton's name in there.
Yep.
Put a bunch of my friends in there. Also Scott Tipton was in there. I think Dave was in there as well. Dave was in the Mirror Universe one. But yeah, I'm always doing that. Chris Ryle is in there. I know Chris Ryle is in a section.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If you know me long enough, you're going to end up in Star Trek somewhere.
So, your art style definitely favors likenesses of different people, and there's just tremendous portraits and pictures of the classic Trek cast that we all know and love. How difficult is it to capture different people's likenesses? Are there certain actors or actresses that are just a piece of cake and easy for you to do, and other ones that you maybe have a little bit more of a challenge doing?
Oh, absolutely. It's all very different. Shatner is a very tough one for me because his face has sometimes a doughy feature to it, but it doesn't look like a doughy face. You know, it's it doesn't exactly have hard angles like, say, Arnold Schwarzenegger, but it does look like he does have a square jaw, even though he has, puffy cheeks, for instance. So it's hard to kind of strike that balance to make him look like himself, because it would either come out, oh, no, that looks like a fat man, or, oh, no, that's too chiseled. And so I struggle with the Captain Kirk likeness at first, and I think I got a little bit better at it. As far as easy, people with very distinguished features, Leonard Nimoy, for instance, that was much easier for me.
Okay.
It really depends there. But to answer your question succinctly, yes, there are some that are really easy and some that are really hard. Yeah.
Do you spend a lot of time watching different episodes of Star Trek and maybe doing some screen grabs and stuff to get certain looks of what you're looking for?
Absolutely. Especially with something like Star Trek, it's not just getting the physicality of the face to get the likeness. You want to try to capture mannerisms. You want to try to capture expressions that the actors would choose to make as that character.
Yeah.
Because Captain Kirk or William Shatner as Captain Kirk is not William Shatner as T.J. Hooker.
Definitely.
You know, so you don't want to focus on capturing William Shatner. You want to focus on capturing Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk.
And you do that through references. You see the choices the actors make, and then you look at the script. And I'm such a fan of Star Trek, and I've seen them all so many times that when I'm reading the script, I immediately, this would be perfect. I know the episode. I know this face, you know, and I'll go back, I'll draw on that. And yeah, I will do a lot of screen grabs of different expressions from different angles. And I pretty much just wallpaper the studio with all of this so that I have that reference. You know.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot easier in this day and age now where you can actually do that, where you can pull up an episode on your computer and you know, pause it and write it in a specific spot and print that out and stick it up on the wall and use that as a reference, as opposed to back in the day when you had to amass a giant folder of actual photographs or magazine clippings and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just as I was reading this story last weekend, I was just every once in a while I'd just be like, oh, I recognize this shot of Kirk. I don't remember what episode it's from, but I you can just, you know, see certain facial features or expressions that it's like, that's I know I've seen this before. I don't remember which one, but I know I've seen it.
Yeah, and I try not to get – I try not to go directly from a screen grab if I can help it. Sometimes, it'll be that expression, but it'll be slightly different angle, or I'll change the lighting. So, because sure. I want you to recognize the character, but I don't want you to go, oh, that's from Mirror Mirror, or that's from – you know, I want it to feel like Kirk without you directly thinking of a different episode, because that takes you outside the story. So I try not to go too exact with things.
Uh-huh.
But there are a couple of those panels, and I'll even name them for you. On the very last page, was it the enemy within? Do you remember that episode where Captain Kirk gets in the transporter accident and it makes two of them?
Yep.
One an evil rapey guy and one kind of a gentle but ineffective soul.
Yep, you bet.
There was a scene where Spock looks a little confused, where he comes in and talks to Captain Kirk after McCoy said he was acting like an asshole. Oh, sorry.
No problem.
Okay. But he comes in and Kirk, it's the nice Kirk, there are two of them out there, and he's talking to Spock and saying like, oh, McCoy's playing a joke on you. And Spock has a certain expression that I was like, oh, that's a really good expression, because he seems more hurt then he does confuse, but he's got both of those expressions in a very Vulcan kind of way, which is a hard thing to pull off. And I actually used an exact screen grab from that and painted it exactly as it was for the second panel of the last page when they're talking, because they're talking about some very heavy stuff. They're talking about Edith Keeler. They're talking about the loss, and I wanted that look of both confusion and pain for his friend to be on his face, but in that very subtle Vulcan kind of way. So there are instances where I'll go, look, I can't do better than this. I'm just going to draw it exactly as you know, Leonard Nimoy did it.
Yep. One of the other things that I was impressed with is your layouts, that the way you lay out pages lends itself very well to seeing an awful lot of backgrounds to your artwork, and not being overly dominated by just portrait shot after portrait shot after portrait shot. That I think also lended itself very well into making this feel like I was kind of watching an alternate version of the episode.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I tried to do that. The temptation, especially in comics, is I wanted to try different angles. If you look at, for instance, the recent Mirror Universe stuff I did, I always do that what I call drawing the Marvel way. We had a book called Drawing the Marvel Way when we were kids. Yep. I'm always doing that, I'm doing a super low, dramatic kind of Alex Ross angle that he likes to use, or I'm doing like the above angle, or just Dutch angles, just something to make it more interesting. But that's not the kind of camera work you do in TV, because it would make everybody motion sick. So I tried to keep it the way it might have been shot. So I tried to think of a director at that time, how they would do it. Now, again, there were exceptions. There was like the opening scene where they beam down to the planet where I did the helicopter. It was more Lord of the Rings than it was Star Trek. But for the most part, I tried to reel myself in from any temptation that it would feel like you're watching an episode. And yeah, I didn't keep too many head and shoulder shots, because during dialogue you will have that back and forth in the television show, but then the camera would eventually pull out so that you could see the scene around them. So I tried to be aware of these things, and years of watching Star Trek kind of made me prepared me for this, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. The two big money shots, for lack of a better term, that I wanted to ask you about is one, the page three one, the psychedelic one. How did you come up with the idea of to basically do a visual interpretation of somebody getting high?
Well, before I was working in comics, I was working in design, and then as a hobby, I guess, or as an enthusiast, I was a surrealist. So I would do paintings at home, okay. And I would go to pretty much those kind of extremes. I would do that kind of stuff. So I feel like I've been training for that before I even got into comics.
Sure.
So I was going back a few years into kind of channeling that part of myself as an artist. And I've always enjoyed the freedom of that, because there's really no wrong way to do it as long as you get the mood across. So it's a little less about the likeness. It's a little less about the pedantry, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's just more about trying to get that mood, which for me is the fun part of art and the most important part. And the thing is, if you don't get everything right, as long as you get the mood right, it's forgiven. You know, we're unlike everything else. So I think I just had fun with it. I think that kind of work kind of flows out of me much more naturally than even storytelling.
Sure. And it's just a very impressive page.
Thanks. That's based on a painting I did a long time ago, too, where I connected, like, I think I shared three eyes.
Yep.
Or four eyes or something like that.
Yep.
Like each face in a different different angle was sharing the other face's eye, and like something I'd done a long time ago. And I was like, you know what, that would be perfect for this, to show the character changing different angles. But you know, there's, you know, you don't even see it at first, then you realize, oh, there's not enough eyes there.
No, it's an amazing shot, an amazing page. The other one that I was very impressed with is when Beckwith gets disintegrated.
Oh yes. Actually, that is the one page I still own. I would not sell it. Actually, there's two pages.
Oh yeah.
There was a page, the romantic page when they were walking across the 59th Street Bridge, which I gave to my ex-wife because it was her favorite page. So she still has that unless she's torn it up. I don't know. And the page I kept, which is sitting actually in my studio right behind me, is that page, because it's one of my favorite pages. And I told you how deep down inside I'm a surrealist, and that came to me. Same goes with horror. I've always been a horror artist. I love sci-fi, and I love horror, but I love sci-fi well over horror. But as an artist, I like painting horror over sci-fi. For me, it's just gore and pain. I don't know, channeling sort of a darkness in the work is a lot of fun for me. So this page where Harlan said, get as dark as you want, kid. You know? I'm like, all right. He's like, I want to feel the burn. All right, you got it. So I kind of had permission. Usually with Star Trek, I remember one of the first things I did was, it was a Klingon book called 4,000 Throats about Kang. It was a one-shot deal back in 2008. Okay. And I got notes from CBS saying, what are you doing with all this blood splatter? I was doing like this Tim Vigil Faust. I don't know if you remember those comics.
Oh, I remember those very vividly.
I was doing gore and splatter. People were getting their guts spilled with these batlets. And they're like, you can't do that. This is Star Trek. I'm like, oh, sorry. But here for once, they're just like, go to town. Go nuts. Because we just all wanted this to be Harlan's vision. So we were kind of following his direction. So I think CBS... after hearing him say that, gave me permission to get a little dark with this. And that's why you got the skulls in there, which I thought, which isn't unprecedented in Star Trek. You saw that in TNG with those horrible disruptors in the first season episode, or maybe it was second season. But you've seen people get disruptor blasts where they disintegrate down to a skeleton before they fade out. So I guess it was okay to do that. But I had a lot of fun disintegrating this guy over and over again. And also the Tiptons gave me a lot of freedom in the script. They said either have three panels go over and over again, you know, showing. You can do it that way. Or if you've got a better idea, you do it. And so I called Dave and Scott. I said, well, what do you think of this? We'll do it like a – because if you look in the book visually, I've been doing in the same way Tim Burton movies always have that, the circles – I was doing kind of the spirals through this, and you see a lot of spiral formations in the panels and wherever I can put it, because that's, and you see that again in that page you just spoke of, the psychedelic.
Most definitely.
So I keep bringing that back. So I knew this had to be a spiral, and I was like, a spiral is perfect, because what better way to show cyclical time, the same moment going over and over again, than to, show it close up, show it fading away, but show the same three shots of him being disintegrated over and over again within the supernova.
Yep.
It all came to me really quick once I had the freedom to do it and I could go as dark as I wanted.
Awesome. Yeah, it's just an amazing shot, and the spiral works out perfectly for showing him meeting his demise over and over again.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I got to say I had fun with it, and obviously I like the page because every artist hates their own art, but you know, I like this. I like the way I felt when I was painting it, so I like having it hang in the studio to kind of inspire me.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned CBS. How much input did CBS have on this? And did they were they harsh critics of your artwork, or were they just kind of, yep, looks good, go with it?
I've always had a good relationship with CBS. Basically, they don't get in the way. They just say yes or no. So okay. You know, even at pitch phase, we'll come up with stuff and then we'll present it to them and they'll say yes or no. Or they'll say, well, you can't do this, or we can't do that. Or sometimes it's because of what they're doing now that they have new shows. We're doing something too close to something they're going to do in the show. Or they have their reasons, but they don't say, well, why don't you do this? Or why don't you do that? They just make sure we don't screw something up that they're very protective of.
Sure.
And when it comes to the art, I've always had good luck with them. Very few changes. I think I can count it on one hand how many times I've had to make changes at all in my career. And it's usually more with covers than the sequential stuff. Okay. I'm struggling to think. I don't think there was anything I had to change on this.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty much, as long as I get the likenesses right, that's usually what they're most concerned with.
Yeah.
They don't like it. They want it to look like the characters. Other than that, usually it's technical stuff, like with Next Generation, sometimes I'm like, oh, I forgot to add a pip. You know, there's only three instead of four or something in a panel. But generally it's, I don't get many changes from them. And with this project, I think we were all looking to Harlan. Because we all wanted it to be his story. We've already seen what Star Trek did with it. We've already seen what CBS Paramount Machine had done with it. I think at the time it was NBC. But we'd already seen that. We wanted to see a different vision. And so we all kind of looked to him. It was more about what he wanted, I think.
Well, I think between you and the Tiptons, I think you did an excellent job of capturing what he would have wanted this story to be in the end. And your artwork just makes it just come alive and makes it feel like you're watching, like I said, you're watching an alternate version of The City on the Edge of Forever. And you did an excellent job, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, that's exactly what we're going for. So it's great to hear that.
And I know since then you've done plenty of stuff. I just read your Mirror Universe story not too long ago. And
that was fun.
And what are you working on now?
Well, right now we're in the midst of the kind of distribution freeze in comics. So, I got a couple more covers, but that's really it. I'm just taking commissions at this point because we're waiting to see
what happens.
Yeah, because we got to, you know, until the retailers open back up, a lot of people are putting their projects on hold so that the retailers can stay open when they get back open. You know, if we keep going on like just digital only, which, you know, would be fine, it would hurt the retailers. So everything's kind of frozen.
Definitely.
So doing commissions, and I did a couple of covers. I did a recreation of a cover for an annual that's coming out. And it's a reprint of a DC annual that was written by John Delante, who played Q.
Oh, okay.
I'm struggling to remember the original artist's name, but I did a homage cover of another very famous DC Star Trek cover that features Q and Picard. So that was the last thing I just did.
Okay. Well, I know you've been keeping busy podcast-wise. I heard you on John Sentris's Word Balloon podcast talking about Star Trek Picard.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Since everybody's been kind of self-isolated, I've actually been doing a lot more on the internet. And since I'm not traveling, I'm not doing these cons. So I'm doing a lot more podcasts, a lot more live broadcasts. We're doing a lot of, online panels, basically, and that's kind of what we were doing there. That started as a live thing on YouTube, I think. And then the audio was put on his podcast.
Oh.
I also have my own podcast that I'm doing. I do a Trek podcast called Go Trek Yourself with Daryl Taylor on the Taylor Network of podcasts.
Oh, awesome.
Where we just review the new stuff, and you know, most of the time just get drunk on the air.
Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, no, it's lots of fun. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, JK, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. And this podcast, the Star Trek panel podcast I'm doing, is very early on in its run. And we have plenty of more Star Trek stories to cover, including some that you have done. So
yeah, you can have me. Again. Yeah, have me back anytime you want. If you want to talk about that, the Broken Mirror Broken,
yep.
I think it was called.
Yep.
Yeah, have me on for that anytime you want.
Awesome. Sounds great. Well, J.K. Woodward, thank you very much. And until next time, thank you.
Thank you.
Transfer of data is complete.
Many thanks to artist extraordinaire J.K. Woodward for joining me on this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel to take a look at the city on the edge of forever. Like he tells you, this is his dream. It was his dream job. It was something that he was super proud to do and to work on. And when you read this story and look at his artwork, you can definitely see how that is the case. I think it's really neat to talk to the artists and find out how they thought about doing stories and how they came up with their ideas for different things. And I hope you enjoyed hearing from J.K. Woodward about doing this miniseries from IDW. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel as well. Please do me a favor, go on iTunes and leave me a positive review. Also, make sure if you have any other Star Trek fans or friends, Star Trek comic fans out there that don't know about this podcast, make sure you let them know. I think that they will enjoy hearing from different writers and artists about different stories that they have read in the past, or maybe this will encourage them to go find a graphic novel or sign up at herocollector.com to start getting some. So, with this episode out of the way, thank you very much for listening, and until next time, this is Jeremy Bement saying live long and prosper. Be safe out there. Thank you for downloading this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, the Internet's premier podcast about Star Trek comics. You can find us on Facebook at Star Trek Panel to Panel and on Twitter at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2. You can always find Star Trek Panel to Panel wherever you get your favorite podcast and can always find previous episodes on archive.org. Please let other Star Trek fans know about this podcast and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, happy readings.